Every day I've tried to choose a passage in which to look at something new about the image of God. And today that image is the image of life. And the story we're going to use is from John chapter 11, the raising of Lazarus. Can we begin with prayer, please? Oh God, your son Jesus said that he has come to bring life in all its fullness. This day, by the power of your Spirit, give us eyes to see and ears to hear, that we may learn anew what it means to be alive. We would ask that your Spirit guide our conversation and our hearts, that we may grasp what it is that you would say to us personally, as well as what you would say to us as your body of believers. This we pray in Jesus' name.
Amen. Amen.
Well, I was kind of looking at my notes and how I did it this first session and whether I want to do that again. I guess we will. We're going to start right away today in this material because it is a very important story, this story. It's so familiar to us that it takes us a while to kind of see it with some new eyes, and that's been my goal, to have people see texts with new eyes. And so what I'd like to do is do what I have tried to help you do every session, which is set the story of Lazarus kind of in its larger context, a larger context. My point has been that John, as a writer, like any writer of a novel or anything else, works from a plot, from a beginning, grows that plot to all kinds of complications, to a climax, and finally to a conclusion. And so in order to understand, say, a story like Lazarus or the blind man or the woman at the well of Samaria or any of the others, if we want to really see it, I think we put it in that context of the greater, and then we understand a little more about what's going on in the story, and not just what we would like to see in the story with the eyes that we bring, which is a good secondary approach to the text. Starting in chapter 10 then, I'm backing up to 10. I'd like to kind of do an outline, if you will, very quick and very basic, of the stories that are going to surround the story of Lazarus. So, starting chapter 10, somebody kind of summarize what some of the themes are there that you see.
Good shepherd.
Okay. We got some stuff about sheep and shepherd. In verse 3 of chapter 10, I believe it is. Somebody read that verse out loud.
To him the gatekeeper opens, the sheep hear his voice, and he calls his own sheep by name and leads them out.
Okay. Give you a big clue here. This phrase here, hear his voice, is an important one when we think about the story of Lazarus. And already in chapter 10, Jesus is tipping you off that a shepherd and a sheep, the sheep know the shepherd and they know the shepherd's voice and they respond to the shepherd's voice. When the gate is open and you say, come little sheepies, if you're not that shepherd, they're not going to follow you anywhere. Forget it. So we know that when Lazarus is, the name Lazarus is called out and the tomb is opened and Jesus says, Lazarus, come forth! You can bet that there is one sheep by the name of Lazarus that's coming out. Okay? Just give you a clue right there. That's how why we read before and after, because what we see is going to be significant to our story. Okay, then we get Good Shepherd. Yes, sir, we do. And what does the Good Shepherd do?
Lays down his life.
Lays down life. Ooh, this will be significant. Okay, moving on. Other things that are in that 10th chapter. Don't need to get in detail because...
The hired hand.
Okay, there's the hired person. Okay, that's the contrast. What else? What's the next section? Move on to the next story. We won't beat this one to death. It's not our story for the day. Something about verse 22. Where does this take place?
Jerusalem.
Jerusalem. The Feast of Dedication. The Portico of Solomon. Temple area. One thing I have not mentioned, a new insight today, if you want to study John at another level, go through and just study Jesus and the different feasts that Jesus attends in the Gospel of John. And what Jesus does, if you will, that expands the meaning of the Jewish feasts. Jesus is around Hanukkah and the Feast of Dedication and Passover and the Atonement, and all of those feasts are all mentioned in the Gospel of John. It's like Jesus kind of shows up during these feast times. Festival of Booths, Jesus is there. Interesting, interesting. In fact, if you want to understand the story of the transfiguration in New Light, understand that that took place during the Festival of Booths. So that when Peter says, Rabbi, you want me to make 3 booths? That has significance. And because we've lost our Old Testament understandings, our First Testament understandings, we don't have a clue as to what that story means. But anyway, that's an interesting study for you. If you want to go home and try something new, look at the feasts. And to give you some help with something like that, I recommend highly that when you study Judaism, you don't read what a Christian says about Judaism, you read what a Jew says about Judaism. This is one book I just found in the library the other day, and I was really glad to see it in there and read a little bit about it. Rabbi Yehiel Eckstein. Yehiel. I don't know, I can't pronounce it. What Christians ought to know about Jews and Judaism. Looks like a really good book.
Another good source are the tapes we have here at Buzz Kahn.
Right, Buzz Kahn has been a teacher, a friend of mine as well, who is a converted Jew to Christianity and born Jewish and became Christian later in his life, has taught here several times. People like that can help us understand really what Judaism is about, and I recommend that if you're going to study Judaism, study it from a Jewish perspective. Much easier, much more reliable than what Christians think Jews ought to think, or whatever. There's a temptation there to put words in their mouth that isn't there. So anyway, we got something about Feast of Dedication, Solomon's Portico, anything happen there that's exciting? Oh, just more sheep talk, huh? Mm-hmm. And Messiah.
One significant word, I am the father of one.
Ah,
having
yeah.
Having with me to attempt to arrest Jesus.
Okay, that's significant theology that we'll be looking at a little bit later. They're going to stone him at that verse 31. Notice, stone him. And so it goes on. And so then the next thing we read about is something called blasphemy. And why has Jesus been accused of blasphemy? What's he say?
The Son of God.
He's the Son of God. Or that he has some identity with the Father. They don't like that. And it's just about then that comes our story of Lazarus. And it's going to have all kinds of meaning because of these previous stories. And you can look at that this story from this perspective, or this perspective, or this perspective, or a number of others. But lest we stop there, where we're always tempted to stop too early, let's go on. The story of Lazarus stops usually for most people about 44. Comes out, Jesus says, unbind him, let him go. Mm-hmm. But let's look and see what goes on from 45 to 12:9 listed there. This is just glancing at the text before we read it. It's okay, we'll do it at that level of glance. So what happens next?
The Pharisees plot the program that will destroy Jesus.
Notice verse 47, not just the Pharisees.
Chief priests.
But the first time the priests appear in the Gospel of John.
Chief priests.
Okay, kind of Pharisees, as John says. Okay, they plot Jesus, they plot Jesus' death.
But the Pharisees are involved simply because they felt they were the, as I understand it, felt that they were the protectors of their Judaism.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. What else goes on here?
Chief priest prophesying his death.
Yeah. There's a little bit of a prophecy here. What else? Let's go to chapter 12 then. What starts there?
Passover.
Okay, Passover. Mm-hmm. Just before the Passover, and Jesus is going to have his crucifixion when? Passover. Okay. In fact, some people are real disturbed because when they start reading Matthew, Mark, Luke, and putting down the Passion story and its details, they notice that John's chronology and their chronology is different. John has things delayed a little longer, so they take place on the Passover. Because John's more interested that you understand the symbol that Jesus is meant to be the Passover lamb than anything else. Okay. So don't let that concern you if you read that. Just understand that John's purpose in using the life of Jesus is to use it for you to understand fully, not necessarily to understand it historically. But what's going on in this chapter 12, 1 to 8?
Dinner for Jesus.
Yeah?
Jesus is verbally concerned about the poor.
Mm-hmm. Who is?
Judas Iscariot.
Mm-hmm. But where does Jesus turn the eyes?
Himself.
Why?
He has denied new life.
Right. What's just happening in there by Mary?
Anointed.
She anoints him. For what?
I don't even think she knew for what.
Look at the last line.
Probably for burial.
She didn't really know that.
Jesus said, leave her alone. She bought it so that she might keep it for the day of my burial. You always have the poor with you, but you do not always have me. Okay? And
then... that's for an excuse not to give to the poor.
Jesus did?
No, people do.
Oh, I know they do. Mm-hmm. And it's a quotation from Deuteronomy 15. It is not to be taken out of the context of Deuteronomy 15. We can look at that later if we get to it. You know, what Jesus says there. Because what's going on here is we're going to have a little story here that's going to push us right into the events of Jesus' death and resurrection in the story of Lazarus. And then in verse 9 through 11, I'll finish it there, I'll just read it out loud to you. When the great crowd of Jews learned that he was there, they came not only because of Jesus, but also to see Lazarus, whom he had raised from the dead. So the chief priests planned to put Lazarus to death as well, since it was on account of him that many of the Jews were deserting and believing in Jesus. I guess in the video last night, which I didn't go over to see, they showed a picture of Lazarus' tomb. The reference was made about Lazarus being put to death as well. And somebody this morning said that's the first time they'd ever heard that. But there it was in the scriptures. I need to kind of review something before we read the text today with you to be sure we keep everybody up, caught up, so I don't in particular lose anyone from what we're doing. I've mentioned before, John's a very, very complex gospel. It's written at two levels. It's written at the level of Jesus' life. The events of Jesus' life in John aren't any different than they are in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. He's born, he's human and divine, he has disciples, John the Baptist is involved, there's healings, there's teachings, there's all kinds of things. There's death, resurrection, and the sending out of the disciples. There's even the Holy Spirit. It's already in the Gospel of John. You don't have to wait to Luke to Acts in the Gospel of John to find it. Jesus breathes on them the Spirit, it says in John 20 or 21. You know, it's the Spirit of Jesus that's given, if you will. The Spirit doesn't come from the Father, it comes from Jesus in the Gospel of John. But anyway, the whole basis of Jesus' life is in the Gospel of John. That's this bottom level. But the top level is the sermonic level that John puts over those events, that you understand the significance of everything Jesus does in fuller ways. Jesus heals a blind person, boy, you're going to get a chapter and a half on it, understanding what the significance was. Talking at a woman of Samaria, whatever the story is. All kinds of images that we've not even talked about, because they're images that, unfortunately, probably take me 2 months to do John fully, and I'd be so exhausted by that time, I don't know what I'd do. But some of those images, like sheep, we haven't looked at sheep. Sheep is a tremendously large image in John. Or what we've gone through, if you're part of the mainline tradition, is that you know we've just read enough about bread to fill a bakery when we've read John. Well, that's an incredibly important image. We don't even touch those. So there's lots and lots of upper layer stuff to work on. And that's why I suggest that we could subtitle this book for mature Christians only. People that had known the stories, they knew the basics, now they needed to know what it means, what the implications are. John's community has diverse theologies. Samaritan Christians, Gentile Christians, Hebrew Christians, Hebrew Jews, Greek-speaking Jews, Romans. He's got everyone in the community. And everyone brings a different theology. And boy, does it show in this gospel. So the question, though, however, that John keeps asking to the community as well as to Jesus and to the story is, who are you and where have you come from and where are you going? You hear that over and over again. And finally, by about the 14th, 15th, 16th, 17th chapters of John, Jesus is going to give you a big, long discourse to clear up all those questions. I and the Father are one. You can read those. John uses signs, the word signs instead of miracles, and signs bring about faith. Signs are also something that John has done to show you that the miracles aren't just big power things. They're not just wow, dazzle, shebang, bang type of experiences. When Jesus does a miracle, it's meant to be more than just something about being divine. It's meant to be something that you see with new eyes. But somebody look up John 20, verse 30, please, and read it to us. John 20, 30.
Now Jesus did many other signs in the presence of the disciples, which are not written in this book. But these are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you may have life in his name.
Signs. Half the Gospel of John is given to signs. There are seven. The raising of Lazarus is number six. There's one yet greater to come. If you think raising Lazarus is a great sign, John says, boy, do I have one for you. Within a week of this time, it happens on the Passover. Okay. And those signs bring about faith. But then the question is believing in the signs enough or not? So we'll have to kind of look at that maybe if we get to it today. This story has no parables. It's rather a parable unto itself. Also, this gospel uses a lot of phrases, uses this phrase in particular, the Jews. Doesn't distinguish the different parties. John, or Mark, is really good. John's got priests, scribes, Pharisees, and Herodians, and zealots, just to name a few, and elders, and all kinds of different people, different parties. John just kind of has lost all of that and calls them all the Jews. It's okay for his community, especially if they're already distinguished as Christians, being apart from the Jews. But it's kind of silly for Jesus to run around and talk to Mary and Martha and Lazarus and all those people and all of a sudden hear about the Jews when they're all Jews. Which Jews? Now they're all Jews. So there are a few distinctions. The temple in John's community has already been destroyed. It was destroyed in AD 70. And after the destruction of the temple, the priesthood really lost its significance. Lost its significance. So you don't hear about priests much in John. In fact, this is about the first time we've heard about him. But in Mark, Jesus is always in contention with priests, much more so than Pharisees. But to John's community, who lived then with the synagogue, that was the place where there was some tension between John's church, if you will, and the synagogue. And our last story a couple days ago about the blind person was a story about fear being put out of the synagogue. The Pharisees have become more prominent than the priests until chapter 12. I'll stop right here because I should probably say this and for a clarification. I've mentioned it a couple times, but to do it again probably wouldn't hurt. When you read the Gospel of Mark and you come to the point, the turning point, like we have today in this story, where the priests plot Jesus' death. In the Gospel of Mark, it comes after a certain event. Can you tell me what that event might be that really angers them? They don't have a raising of Lazarus. They have something else in Mark's Gospel.
Working on the Sabbath?
Not quite. That would be a Pharisee issue, and it wasn't enough to put him to death. You know, they were angry with him about it, but they would kill him for it.
Cleansing the temple.
In Mark, Jesus is going to be put to death because he's cleansed the temple and said, I'm the temple. You don't need a temple. That's going to be destroyed. I'll rule this world will be raised up. Oh, you think that made him angry or what? And that is what put Jesus to death in Mark. In Luke, do you know what it is that puts Jesus to death? Interesting. Looking for my notes here just to be sure you're ready. And I don't give you the wrong answer. There we go. Yeah, okay, let me give you some citations if you're interested in this. It's Mark 11:18, dealing with the cleansing of the temple. In Luke, it's chapters 19:47-48, and then 20 and verse 19. And this is what Jesus is teaching about himself in Luke. Jesus, the teacher, is what puts him to death in Luke. In Matthew, we don't really know. Matthew just says Jesus put to death by the priests, but we don't really know what it was that Jesus did. Now, Matthew's very vague. But in John, what is it? What puts Jesus to death?
Raising
of Lazarus. It's as if the life that Jesus is offering is so potentially threatening that they can't deal with it. You see, the Pharisees had belief in life after death, and Martha mentions that. Remember, Jesus will talk to her. Well, we haven't read the story yet, so I guess you can't remember that. Giving myself away here. But Martha really will express the faith of the Pharisees, that there's life after death. Pharisees believe that, but the priests didn't. Okay, the Sadducees didn't believe there was any life after death. But the Pharisees did. But Jesus is saying, that's not the kind of life I'm talking about, Martha. I want to show you the kind of life I'm talking about. That's going to get Jesus in very deep trouble. Not that the other things don't, it kind of builds up to it, but let's say the straw that breaks the camel's back. Okay. Anyway, that's a little bit of a discourse off on that. I'm kind of that way. I just, you know, wander off my own way, like, a sheep. You know, hear the voice and come back. John uses some writing techniques, too, to help you understand when John writes, gives you a little more clarity on what's going on. Contrasts are one of them. What are some contrasts we've heard in the last week?
Light and dark.
Light versus darkness. What others?
Life and death.
Life and death.
Clean and unclean.
Clean and unclean. Not so much in John, but that's one of them, yeah. Okay. Born from above or born again.
Water, living water.
Blind, see at sight. To know based on, okay, those kind of things. Okay? Irony, what's that? He was getting good. You go home really knowing your John.
When you say something is true without knowing you've said it.
Yeah. Nathaniel, can anything good come out of Galilee? The woman at the well, he can't be the Messiah, can he? Things that are said by a character, they don't know what they're saying. And we've got a couple of biggies in John. And we read this. So we give you all the things you need to see, our tools to see, and then when we read it, I hope this stuff just starts going like this for you. Misunderstandings. Like Nicodemus. Jesus said, you must be born anophen. Two choices of how the word's interpreted. Born anew or born from above. Nicodemus looks and says, how can I be born anew? Can I enter my mother's womb again? Misunderstanding. Because Jesus is saying, you must be born from above. Not anew. From above. Ooh. And we have a couple of those. We have hints. John likes to hint what's coming up. He's real good at that. In fact, starts the story off in chapter 11 talking about Mary who anoints Jesus' feet, and he hasn't even told that story yet. That's in the next chapter. So it's like he identifies the character with a story that's not even, the reader doesn't even know yet. Except that they know this. You know, the underlying story. And then there's symbols. Sheep, bread. All kinds of symbols of things. Okay. Enough said. We need to read. Okay. Lots of setting context. Okay, now we've contexted ourselves to death. Let's see if we can get some reading going here. We need someone to read 11 from 1 to 16.
Okay.
Anybody? That one? Okay. And then we need someone from 17 to 37. 17, 37? Please. 38 to 44, please. 45 to 57, thanks, and 12, 1 to 11. 12, 1 to 11? Yes. Okay, here we go.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Now a certain man was ill, Lazarus of Bethany, the village of Mary and her sister Martha. It was Mary who anointed the Lord with ointment and wiped his feet with her hair, whose brother Lazarus was ill. So the sister said to him, saying, Lord, he whom you love is ill. But when Jesus heard it, he said, this illness is not unto death. It is for the glory of God, so that the Son of God may be glorified by means of it. Now Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. So when he heard that he was ill, he stayed 2 days longer in the place where he was. Then after this, he said to the disciples, "Let us go into Judea again." The disciples said to him, "Rabbi, the Jews were but now seeking to stone you. And are you going there again?" And Jesus answered, "Are there not 12 hours in the day? If anyone walks in the day, he does not stumble, because he sees the light of this world. But if anyone walks in the night, he stumbles, because the light is not in him." Thus he spoke, and then he said to them, "Our friend Lazarus has fallen asleep, but I go to awake him out of sleep." The disciples said to him, "Lord, if he has fallen asleep, he will recover." Now Jesus had spoken of his death, but they thought that he meant taking rest in sleep. Then Jesus told them quite plainly, "Lazarus is dead. And for your sake I am glad that I was not there, so that you may believe. But let us go to him." Thomas, called the twin, said to his fellow disciples, "Let us also go, that we may die with him."
Now when Jesus came, he found that Lazarus had already been in the tomb 4 days. Bethany was near to Jerusalem, about 2 miles off, and many of the Jews had come to Martha and Mary to console them concerning their brother. When Martha heard that Jesus was coming, she went and met him while Mary sat in the house. Martha said to Jesus, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. And even now I know that whatever you ask from God, God will give you." Jesus said to her, "Your brother will rise again." Martha said to him, "I know that he will rise again in the resurrection at the last day." Jesus said to her, "I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me, though he die, yet shall he live. And whoever lives and believes in me shall never die. Do you believe this?" She said to him, "Yes, Lord, I believe that you are the Christ, the Son of God, he who is coming into the world." When she had said this, she went and called her sister Mary, saying quietly, "The teacher is here and is calling for you." And when she heard it, she rose quickly and went to him. Now Jesus had not yet come to the village, but was still in the place where Martha had met him. When the Jews who were with her in the house, consoling her, saw Mary rise quickly and go out, they followed her, supposing that she was going to the tomb to weep there. Then Mary, when she came where Jesus was and saw him, fell at his feet, saying to him, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died." When Jesus saw her weeping, and the Jews who came with her also weeping, he was deeply moved in spirit and troubled. And he said, "Where have you laid him?" They said to him, "Lord, come and see." Jesus wept. So the Jews said, "See how he loved him." But some of them said, "Could not he who opened the eyes of a blind man have kept this man from dying?"
Jesus, once more deeply moved, came to the tomb. It was a cave with a stone laid across the entrance. "Take away the stone," he said. "But Lord," said Martha, the sister of the dead man, "by this time there is a bad odor, for he has been there 4 days." And Jesus said, "Did I not tell you that if you believed, you would see the glory of God?" So they took away the stone. Then Jesus looked up and said, "Father, I thank you that you have heard me. I knew that you always hear me, but I said this for the benefit of the people standing here, that they may believe that you sent me." When he had said this, Jesus called in a loud voice, "Lazarus, come out." The dead man came out, his hands and feet wrapped in strips of linen and a cloth around his face. Jesus said to them, "Take off the grave clothes and let him go."
Many of the Jews, therefore, who had come with Mary, had seen what he did, believed in him. But some of them went to the Pharisees and told them what Jesus had done. So the chief priests and the Pharisees gathered the council and said, "What are we to do? For this man performs many signs. If we let him go on thus, everyone will believe in him, and the Romans will come and destroy our holy place and our nation." But one of them, Caiaphas, was the high priest that year, said to them, "You know nothing at all. You do not understand what it is expedient for you that one man should die for the people, and that the whole nation should not perish." He did not say this of his own accord, but being high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus should die for the nation, and not for the nation only, but to gather into one of the children of God who are scattered abroad. So from that day on they took counsel how to put him to death. Jesus therefore no longer went out about openly among the Jews, but went from there to the country near the wilderness to a town called Ephraim, and there he stayed with the disciples.